interrupt or ask any questions you'd like.
I don't have the sense of the of the group that the suggestion that doing the things that have been put forward as recommendations should wait on the study. In other words, I think what I'm hearing is the group believes that there are recommendations coming out of here that are ripe for consideration and some kind of addressing, handling by the board, although the study goes on. And at the end, a question or two on a couple of the comes up, but Norman, you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to get back to my, I think Mike Starr made both a very astute observation and asked a very important question. I think it underlies actually a lot of what we talked about today. I have no doubt that if there was a fourth side to our tables here today and the four vice chairs of audit from the big four firms were sitting there, we'd have a vigorous discussion about whether there's sufficient objectivity in the audit process today and probably a lot of disagreement around that question. And ironically, as I thought about it, as I heard Mike discuss the issue, it occurred to me that in some respects the an assessment or a formation of a view about whether an audit or an audit process involves a sufficient degree of objectivity is in any respects a subjective determination. Reasonable minds will disagree because at the end of the day it comes down to its behavior. It's human conduct, and as with most things involving human conduct, what determines it is incentive structures. So I think where you come at the end of the day is to a question, among others, of whether there are consistent and uniform and sufficient incentives in place to ensure the kind of behaviors you want to see occurring regularly in an audit process, and that is the willingness to engage in rigorous scrutiny, to ask difficult questions, to demand candid and forthright answers, and to communicate results of all kinds, good, bad, and indifferent. And that, in turn, goes to a whole host of issues around audit. The structure of the profession, the structure of the firms, transparency, range of service offerings, transparency of the audit process, which we discussed earlier today, and a lot of the other issues that have been on the table today. So I think it is a vitally important question, and I think one that underscores a lot of what we have talked about and what I suspect the board will want to consider going forward. But at the end of the day, it is a profession, and professions involve people, and people are creatures whose behavior is determined in large part by incentives, and I think that's something that we in the board should always keep in mind as we talk about how to improve the audit process and bring what I think everyone would agree is the very desirable goal of increased scrutiny and objectivity to that process.
This is Gus Sauter. It may not surprise anyone that the representative from Vanguard would say costs do matter. I think any undertakings should consider cost-benefit, and I think the benefits are substantial. Joe mentioned earlier that some of this really wouldn't be very costly. You know, a lot of the analysis is being done by auditors already. Better disclosure really shouldn't be that costly. But I wouldn't throw cost considerations away. There have been studies done since the implementation of Sarbanes-Oxley, which is a very costly legislation, that show a secular decline in IPO activity and at the same time an increase in privatization. So, you know, there are some costs that could be hitting economic growth because of significant regulation. Nevertheless, I think there is a huge conflict of interest when management selects an auditor. First, management is selecting the auditor. Management is paying the auditor. But management is using the investor's checkbook to write the check on. So, consequently, we have this situation where the auditor isn't tied to the investor. They're tied to management. And I wonder if there isn't a way to figure out how to tie the auditor to the investor. And could that be, I don't know if Joe was literally suggesting this, could that be setting up an investor group? And I'm thinking something different from independent board members, but an investor group whose sole function would be to hire auditors. It's perhaps dangerous to try to think of these things on the fly, but I think that it would be important to somehow culturally align the auditors with investors. And again, hopefully that wouldn't be overly expensive. So while I do agree with most of the comments here, you know, there is a cost at which you say no. But $1 trillion worth of extra cost probably is not worth it. I'll be so bold as to say it's not worth it. But hopefully there are ways to make significant changes without incurring overly burdensome costs.
Before it goes back to the end, I did have a question about Robert Tarna's notion about firm financials. This is an area that keeps coming up. And to what extent, I think you did indicate that one of the uses of firm financials would be creditworthiness, whether there was something behind the attestation. To what extent does that really induce to a run on the bank type situation? Is it appropriate for the board to be attentive to that? We are veering away in our philosophical orientation in this country from too big to fail. Does the receipt and use of firm financials tend to pull the regulator more into a too big to fail analysis? I just ask these as questions, and I think that one of the things I am sensitive to is that there are very few public institutions that don't have audited financials. I mean, there are some. But universities have them. Labor unions may or may not. But the fact is, what use would be the appropriate use of the firm financial?
Chairman Doty, the direct answer is yes, but in a qualifying way. When boards hire auditors and Gus, the audit committee is responsible for that hiring activity. And I know people have said management, and maybe that's an indication that people around the room think management and the board are the same thing, and maybe that's, you know, maybe that is true in some cases. But when you hire an auditor, you don't have that information. It's really the trust me model that the financial wherewithal stands behind the firm. Now, because I was a partner with the firm, I know that most of the cash is distributed out on an annual basis. So the creditworthiness is really around cash flow. And should that be interrupted, problems will arise, I believe. So I think it is relevant to the system overall, to the financial reporting system and the quality of the markets, to have some indication that the those who are rendering opinions over the quality of reporting have the wherewithal to stand behind those opinions.
Whether it would have mattered to Robert Tarullo, CFO, to know whether the firm had more or less cash flow and capital than someone else you were considering would be a question. In other words, would it matter to you that firm A had more than firm B, or would there be other ways firm B could show you that they would deliver a better audit? These are things I think we will eventually hit. You don't have to opine on these today. And I guess the other thing is, what difference does it make in terms of that issue of the quality of the audit if in fact people are looking at what is really a distributable cash flow statement at year end? How does it factor into your assessment of whether the audit's good?
It's not, in my view, a factor into whether or not one firm will deliver a better audit than the other. I think that's more that consideration and judgment is more around the expertise of the firm and or the people involved with your audit. I think from the standpoint of representing a company, however, if you thought one of the prospects for performing your audit did not have the wherewithal to stand behind their work, that would be a consideration. I think that's in degrees, so it's not absolute.
Lynn, I know that this was a recommendation of ACAP and one that you feel strongly about. So if you could take a minute and just indicate how you think investors will benefit from individual firms providing annual financial statements prepared in accordance with GAAP, I'd appreciate your getting that into the record. And then we'll turn to Board Member Hansen.
Yeah, like I share the thoughts that Bob had, having been a partner as well at one of these firms. I do think any time you're starting to make your financial statements public and put information out there, that very well may have an impact on how you behave. You asked the question about how this ties to audit quality, which is a fair question from your perspective. I know there's been some diversity in views in the board about whether or not you should be a regulator of just audit quality or go beyond that. What I would tell you is ultimately at the end of the day, audit quality gets back to the people that you can attract, just like the quality of a law practice gets back to the quality of the attorneys you have in the law practice and your ability to attract the very best and brightest and pay the most for those. I mean, it just goes hand in hand. You can't make an assessment about that unless you're able to see how these firms are performing. All of these firms are highly leveraged, extremely highly leveraged, thin capital. Because of what Bob said, you distribute most of the money out each year because you not only want to put out the earnings, but you got to put out enough money to pay the taxes on it. So for the most part, they operate and their capital is provided by the banks that turn around and support them with their annual revolving lines of credit. Given the fact that they're thinly capitalized, that they're highly leveraged, they all have a call on their partners, though, because that, quite frankly, is where perhaps the biggest assets lie off balance sheet. It would seem to me, if I was trying to oversee that company, I'd want to know just how levered and how close they are to the edge, and I'd also like to know what they're doing in the way of investing in their people. You know, is your payroll, is the payroll of one firm running 40% of revenues, another one running 45% of revenues? Are they investing enough? Are they investing enough in technology? And quite frankly, are they generating sufficient margins to allow to make those investments and still return enough money to the partners to entice the partners to stay there and do a very good job? You can't get that type of information unless you're getting those financial statements. And for those of us who vote on reappointment of the auditors, that's a very valid piece of information. You talk about the run on the bank. Is it important to me to know that a bank has 10% capital versus 3% capital? Yeah, it is.
But that would be an argument about making it available to the audit committee hiring them, but not publicly available, perhaps.
No, because I'm being asked, and in fact, ACAP recommended that every public company give its shareholders a vote on the auditors. That is important information to me. When I turn around and vote on the auditor, I shouldn't be doing that in the dark. I should be doing it from an informed position. So why wouldn't I want to know the financial stability and viability of an audit firm I'm voting for and know that it's making the reasonable investments in its people? I think it's common sense that you'd want to turn around and have that information. And actually, I had this discussion with the partner of a large regional firm that audits many public companies about 2 months ago about the financials. Do you put them out or not? His biggest concern, and what this person, very good partner, very good auditor, but what his concern was that because the firms are so thinly capitalized and because they have such a huge OPEB liability, their exposure, their financial stability isn't around the liability issue for litigation, because that's dropped off the cliff at this point in time because of court cases. Their biggest exposure is the liability to their retired partners for health care and retirement. And at ACAP, despite the fact we pleaded with them to give us financial information and they refused to, the limited data that they did give us indicated that perhaps one or two of these, if you did a gap basis set of financials, because of the OPEB liability, would actually have negative capital. And yet you're sitting here as five board members today, and you don't know, given the significant leverage of these companies, whether one of them does have negative capital or not. How can you regulate such a significant public franchise if you can't even tell one of the companies, one of the four that audits most of these public companies, is sitting there with negative capital? And you can't know unless you get that information. If it ever blows up, there won't be any place for you to run and hide, because the public will be coming back and saying, why weren't you getting this? Why didn't you know it? And there's no answer to that question. That'll be on the front page in the New York Times, and there's just no answer. There's no rock you can go and hide under when that one pops. So, just a thought.
Board Member Hansen speaking. Question I want to frame for a number of you. I've heard a couple different comments about the use of various specialists that auditors need to use. Lynn, you mentioned forensic auditors. Judge Sporkin mentioned the same thing. One of the most difficult areas in the audits of the big banks is the evaluation of the complex financial instruments, that you need the top people on earth to help help value those. And there are other examples as well. Norman, I think you had mentioned the need for subject matter experts in the firms to be involved. And another area this comes up is in income taxes, that the line auditor has a really difficult time with income tax. They need the help of the specialists in that area. In the IT area, that's another example. Actuaries are another example. It's been my personal experience that bean counter auditor types like me kind of like doing that for a living. Folks that are highly specialized in areas of financial instruments and income taxes, they don't like being an auditor, otherwise they'd be an auditor. They like doing their craft. So one of the challenges is they have to be able to do their craft to stay current, as well as have the skills to help the auditors. So that's one of the areas where I'm just kind of curious as to your thoughts about how do you reconcile the need that the auditors have to have those kind of people readily at hand to help them do their job in these most complex areas. Yet the cry is coming out that with the split of the audit practices and the other consulting services, things like that, the arguments that were coming up 10 years ago are front and center in the table now. I'm just kind of curious as to the connection between those two, that if the firms do not have ready access to those people that are the best, how are they going to accomplish what we're identifying as a really, really significant need for those people to be involved in the audits?
Jay, and you're right, that did come up a lot during the discussion over the auditor independence back in 2000. The problem was that, for the most part, the auditors and those experts just don't get along in the firms. And so you didn't have that exchange of information going from the consulting side, if you will, into the audit side. And the firms all still to this day still have the consulting practices, and they're growing. They just don't do it for the very same companies that they audit. So in that context, it shouldn't be an issue, because the expertise is there and should be available. The real question is, why isn't that, as we talked about with the forensic people, why isn't that expertise inside the firm being brought into the audit? And I think that's a legitimate question. The other thing is, when you use outside experts, either in the actuarial area or others, all too often the auditors just take that report, plop it in the work papers, tie it out, and don't really do what the standard requires them to do with respect to that report. There's a fairly decent standard, I think, from the old Auditing Standards Board in that regards, and I think in that area, I think more than a standard issue, it's a performance and enforcement issue, but it really ultimately gets down to, either internally or externally, are the auditors putting the experts that they really should be on those audits?
And Lynn, I agree that historically it's been a challenge of the auditors and the consultants playing nice together, and I think it's gotten a lot better. I think the larger engagement teams use the specialists. They have no choice because they need them to understand the complex.
Not sure I'd agree with that, Jay, because if you look back over the large banks and the valuation issues that were there at Lehman and at Citigroup and the likes, I would turn around and raise a serious question. AIG is another prime example. I would raise a serious question as to whether or not there was really an independent, unbiased view that came into the pricing of those assets. I think history tells us that there were serious deficiencies there. So
I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm just saying directionally it's better than it had been from my direct experience as well as experience talking to a lot of the other firms. And my concern, to restate it, is if we go down this road, as some are calling for, to effectively split the firms into being audit-only firms, that's only going to exacerbate that problem of having the best expertise available to the auditors.
You know, Paul Volcker has been a big fan and vocal proponent of that, and I value Paul's counsel tremendously. I'm not sure that's true. I'm not sure I would agree with you. I think you could go get that expertise. And what you'd have to weigh is, would you get a more thorough, robust audit because it was a firm that was very focused on the public franchise but had to go get outside experts and bring them in? Or would you have a better audit where there were conflicts internally less objectivity on the part of the auditor as a result of that? You know, it's a good issue, good question. I'm not sure, but what Paul isn't right about it, and it comes back to the question that someone raised. Oh, I know, it was Mike. Mike raised the very first question. Who do you view as your client? If you go back and look at that initial slide that I put up from Deloitte & Touche, from their international headquarters, on their website, they give you the answer to that question. It is not investors. They talk about their clients. It's the businesses. As long as you have that mentality, then I think Volcker may absolutely be right. And Paul isn't a pure audit firm. He has no problem with bringing in some expertise and having that resident. But when you've got the mentality that these firms have demonstrated, and then they're telling you who their client is. They aren't asking. They're telling you. That raises a very significant issue. And back to Mike's question about the overall issue of a real serious look at how do you come up with a remedy here. You know, most people have talked about mandatory rotation. They've talked about perhaps having the stock exchanges through some type of fee arrangement, pick them and all. I think what Gus mentioned is the key. You got to build that link between the investor somehow and the audit firm. I personally believe that if you take the ACAP recommendation and the SEC adopts requiring companies or have the listing requirements that auditors appoint the auditor, and then you go with the mandatory rotation, I think that's the easiest, most cost-effective way to do it that there is. And we've studied this thing for 50 years. I agree with Chairman Doty. Another study is a waste of time, you know, at this point in time. We've studied this thing to death. If people can't figure out, given all the studies, how to do it at this point in time, then we're probably a lost cause. And 20 years down the road, the digitalization will take care of that. But I think the real key thing is the answer has to come back to what Gus said, and there has to be that link. That first slide has to change. That first slide has to be transformed into when they're talking about clients, they're talking about investors.
Brandon, we haven't heard from you for a while, so why don't we just go over to you.
Oh, just a small point. I thought Board Member Hansen's description of the problem is correct, and it's an ongoing one. The only thing I was going to add was it's not unique to the accounting firms in the sense that regulators have that on a routine basis. We have that when you're trying to build a risk team that's going to evaluate what your traders are doing. Broker-dealers or old broker-dealers had it when they'd lose traders to hedge funds. Unfortunately, the answer, at least in our experience, is you got to pay people the right amount of money, and you've got to create a career path, and you can't do it overnight. Whether or not structural division is the way to get it, I'm not sure. I wouldn't opine on whether structural division ensures that, but I am confident that if you don't have a career path and you don't have the right amount of money that you're paying them, you're not going to get the talent that you need in parallel, because then you've got to try and create a culture where they're on a par and willing to talk seriously to people and be listened to.
Yeah, well said. That was my point.
Mike?
I just want to correct one thing when I ask my question. What I envisioned was not a study. What I envisioned was a study with a call to action. So I don't want another study that just sits on the shelf someplace and gathers dust. I wanted to share two things, a couple of thoughts from lunch. Tony and I had a discussion about the importance of words. And there are two examples I want to share with you that underscore the importance of words, and both of them come from a speech that Jim Croker gave at the SEC. The first is that it's responsive to the question, do auditors consider investors their clients? When you look at the auditing literature, in fact, you look at the literature of the PCAOB, it refers to the client, meaning the businesses that are audited. And I would simply submit, as Jim submitted at the SEC conference, that we should change that phrasing to talk about the companies that auditors audit and not refer to them as clients. So that's the first example. The second example, let me take you back a step. The code of conduct for AICPAs has four either key phrases that are either words or phrases. They are integrity, objectivity, due professional care, and public interest. Several times today, in referring to my profession, if I can call it that, people have talked about the accounting industry. If you really believe in that code of conduct, as I do, and you really believe that auditors have a duty to the public, then I think it's more appropriate to refer to the accounting profession as a profession, not an industry, because I don't think an industry has a duty of care to the public. Thank you.
Well, Mike, how do you bring it back to becoming a profession when so many people now are associating it as an industry?
You lead.
Yeah.
You lead. That's how.
Well, I'm speaking for myself once again. I think you put your finger right on it, and Jim did as well, and the chairman. And that is, I think, that a lot more attention has to be paid to the fact that auditors should view their investors as their clients. I don't think that's the case right now, and I think that does have to be changed. Jim?
I just had a follow-up for Lynn. I think, one, Lynn, Robert, Judge Sporkin, great presentation and, I think, great thoughts. The one area I wanted to follow up on was, particularly as it relates to the issue of transparency, whether the group gave any thought to greater transparency around the inspections and the findings, whether that's part one into to the company under audit, so their audit committee, is there enough transparency there? And then part two, of course, is non-public, but nothing precludes a firm from making that information public. And, of course, somebody with a public responsibility and a public interest could go that further step of making that part two, quality control questions and concerns and criticisms, public, and of course that could drive greater accountability on the part of the firm for responding to those concerns. So I don't know if the group thought about that.
Actually, in the very first phone call, one of our members who serves on a number of audit committees raised the concern that in that capacity, they had a very difficult time getting information regarding what the quality of the audit was on a global basis. It was almost impossible to get. That was some comment that was made in the very first phone call. And I, having served on and chairing an audit committee of a global company like that, I would agree with that. So I think that's a very valid point. We don't have it in the recommendations, obviously. I would turn around and say that when the reports first started coming out, there were discussions amongst audit committee members about trying to get these. And I believe, actually, at the very beginning, one or two of these reports actually got turned over to an audit committee, as I recall. But then it seemed like the Big Four got together and squelched that. And so since then, they haven't been forthcoming. There's no question that there is nothing that precludes a Big Four firm, if they really want to be transparent here, if they want to walk the talk, so to speak, that they could, in fact, go allow that and give it to audit committee members. But they have chosen not to, which is unfortunate. It's why you got to be, you know, when they talk about everyone being transparent, it seems like everyone needs to be transparent but them. It would be great if they would change that view and start to be thinking out of the box and becoming more open and transparent. I just think these are animals that, by the nature of how they're operated and run and how they pick their leadership, the chances of that are not high. And I think that's, I think Steve knows this well, that's a point that myself and former SEC Commissioner Goldsmith have been very vocal on, that we think these ought to be made public. You need to change the legislation. So,
Tony? And then I indicate to a number of people here that we wrap up at 3:30 or close to it. So why don't we begin to
I'll be brief. I just wanted to mention that when I said that costs don't matter as much, what I meant was that relative to the benefits, they don't. The second point I'd like to make is in response to something Gus said, that there's been a secular decline in IPOs. I think part of that, I don't know if I saw the same studies, but I've seen some. And I left those studies with a feeling that they could have been written and actually designed a lot better, because they did not acknowledge or include the change in private equity acquisitions that took place. They did not take into account the change in M&A activity in the same period. And they did not take into account a very common thing in on the West Coast, where a lot of private companies are being gobbled up by the companies that they are doing little bits and pieces of work for. So I don't know that there has been, I'm not sure about the relationship there between causality and correlation between the advent of SOX and you know, whether there actually has been a decline. Jay Hansen had asked about, mentioned about different experts, and Brandon responded to it, and I think the point there is that these companies, the audit firms, need those experts. They need to use them. That's the cost of those experts, whether they are acquired through a career path or whether they're rented every by the hour or something like that. I don't mean to be offensive using the term rented, but I'm just saying that if you do it that way, I don't care. The point is that it's part of the cost of the audit, and it ought to be included. If they're not using them, and the only thing that the only way that they seem to be able to survive is by having a separate consulting firm, then I think, you know, this goes back to Lynn, to EITF 0021, and now to 081. I think somebody's not doing separation and allocation correctly. And, you know, that's all I would say with respect to, I think it's absolutely critical that they have these the different expertise that you listed, and it should be part of the cost of doing the audit.
My tent actually went back up when the chairman was asking questions, and I will resist the temptation to comment on all the other issues that have come up since then. contrary to what Lynn said, I'm pretty sure you didn't say you thought a study was a waste of time. But I think you did ask whether you needed to wait for a study before you acted. And I think there are two separate sets of issues. There are issues that have been studied to death. The ACAP report has a number of recommendations that were based on extensive study. And so there's no need to go back and restudy the things that we've studied in order to justify acting on things that have been well researched and thought out. There are, I think, another set of issues that where we don't know, you know, everything that we need to know what the recommendations would be. And that's where, you know, I think it would be wise to start with some analysis. On the issue of financial statements, one of the things that we should have learned from the financial crisis, and this relates perhaps is a less colorful way of saying something that Lynn said, is we do not want to discover that these firms are too big to fail when they're at the point of failure. And right now, you're flying blind. You know, you're very much in the position that you could find yourself where things are falling apart and you're dealing with a firm that's you know, coming apart, and you didn't know because you didn't have adequate transparency. And so, you know, I think there's an incontrovertible case for the regulator having access to that information. But I also think Lynn is right. You know, if the sort of continuing theme here is that we want investors to be the ones who are being reported to, if we want them to take more ownership of this process, part of that is getting them more involved in these decisions about hiring and firing the auditor, and part of that requires having greater transparency about the financial condition of the auditor.
Brandon, I thought that you and Tony and Barbara, your group, was recommending in terms of the study, a study of what went wrong. And is essentially, I think your words, Brandon, although I don't have them in front of me, but you wanted to have, when you first brought it up at the first meeting, an autopsy. And that's essentially what you're talking about. It's a selective autopsy of what went wrong. Am I correct in that? Or maybe I think the chairman may have a question on this in terms of between Tony and Brandon and Barbara. I think we may need some help.
I think I understand. I take a clear message away that what's wanted is a well-designed focus study on why auditors in major financial institutions that had these problems in this particular era felt that they could issue clean audit opinions and had none of the constraints to going and calling, sounding a warning to a toxin to the audit committee, and that has to be structured. I do not want this discussion as elevated and I think as illuminating as it has been to end on the issue of the auditor financial statements. But Barbara, if we are going to be what I will call a stringent regulator, a regulator who is insisting on accountability if you violate rigidly imposed standards, one would say we do not, if you have this simple mission idea that one takes away from the SEC, for example, one would say we do not want to be petitioned by a company that is doing the wrong thing and taking in audit clients by the argument that we cannot pull the plug, that we cannot sanction that client, we can't end their ability to take clients because this is going to be the one network member of the firm that pulls the whole firm down. We don't want to be seen to be thinking primarily about whether this firm can take another $1 million penalty. That seems to me to be the dilemma here. In other words, I do think that there is intense competition in the audit profession. I don't think we know where that's going to lead. And I would like to be where I think Arthur Levitt and the commission and others were when the competition was between, by analogy here, the automated market of NASDAQ and the institutional auction market of the NYSE. And Brandon and the team at that time were very careful not to put their thumb on the scale and determine that outcome, you see. And I am concerned that this is an area I think demands a lot of further exploration among wise heads, because I'm concerned that the question that you're posing about why didn't you do something has a simple answer now, and that is it isn't our business. We're not the business model renovators of an accounting firm, an auditing firm. I'm concerned that that answer then is complicated if, in fact, there was something which the firm asked us to do that involves suspension of standards, suspension of accountability. That's the dilemma. I think we do not now have, as a board, a moral hazard in regulating audit firms. What concerns me about the financial statement question is that it implies inserting ourselves into a moral hazard position. That's philosophically the way it reads. And I do hear, though, what Robert Trolla says about the fact that, you know, that people might want to know if you're in a negative capital position, if you're the audit committee chairman, whether they hire you. My impression is not that's not the way audit committees make those decisions. But that's just to explain why I find this to be a very difficult subject.
Right. Can I just a couple of points? One, I agree. I don't want you making decisions about disciplining firms based on their financial condition. My point is, you will be asked to make those decisions. And it came up in the KPMG tax shelter case. There were press reports of people saying, well, we can't discipline KPMG because, you know, we can't afford to lose another audit firm. So that issue arises regardless of whether there's transparency or not. If there's transparency and you know what's going on, you're actually in a position to make the audit firms do some things to get in a better financial condition, including one of the ideas that's floated around the living will notion. But I do think, and I don't mean this to be disrespectful, but I think you're kidding yourself if you think you don't have a moral hazard now, because the issue will present itself when it's presented itself, and it won't matter that there was a logic behind the position that you took at the time.
That's a telling point. This is a discussion we're going to have to continue. I do think that we spoke to this at the top of the meeting, in a sense, that in fact I do not know of a single regulatory civil action that ever sunk a major accounting firm. See, on the other hand, If you're telling me that if looking at an accounting firm that I think is shaky, that Jay Hansen tells me is shaky, we should send its clients elsewhere, we should go and ask the Treasury to provide financing. And this, by the way, is I think what Mr. Bernier has in mind, that the government would provide sort of a cushion so that audit clients of KPMG in Germany would go over to firms, a consortium of local firms in Germany that would audit them. I think these are ideas that are not well conceived, but I acknowledge to you we will have an argument at that time. If that happens, we will have an argument. I do not believe that we're in a position right now to structure an orderly plan of liquidation for a global accounting firm. It seems to me to be beyond the ken of any regulatory institution. And, in fact, I think one of the great disappointments that has come out of this financial crisis by the American public is that we have demonstrated the incapacity of the Fed to do this for banking institutions. The Fed has lost credibility over this. But this is to tell you why I find the issue difficult. It's not to foreclose further discussion on the issue.
And I wanted to ask a question along those lines. And first of all, I share, Barbara, your concern and Lynn's your concern on this subject. And I think it is an extremely difficult issue. I don't want to end the day without discussing or getting any ideas as to whether or not anybody here has any concerns about the issue of concentration in the public company audit market. It's been a very hot topic that's raised repeatedly by the European Commission. We have a highly concentrated profession. BDO, for example, in its response to the European Green Paper, recommended, among other things, the outlawing of all artificial intervention by third parties, e.g. lenders, and the appointment of statutory auditors through restrictive clauses or lending processes which discriminate in favor of borrowers appointing particular audit firms or members of a particular group of audit firms. And Grant Thornton and others had similar concerns, as did others who responded to the European Union. I'm wondering whether anybody here shares those concerns and has any ideas whatsoever in terms of how to promote competition.
You know me, I always have opinions, so I'll just jump in. I actually see this issue differently, and perhaps in part because I've spent a lot of time in the last 18 months working on credit rating agency issues. Competition, increased competition without increased independence is likely to occur on terms that are not beneficial to investors. If there's more competition for business and it's competition to win management's favor, we're not going to be happy with the results. So while I do have concerns about the degree of concentration that exists, including for this issue that I think there is, has been, and I've been very encouraged by the chairman's comments, I think there has been a reluctance to discipline the big audit firms because of the sense that they're too big to fail. I think you need to think very carefully about what happens when you get competition and it promotes a race to the bottom.
I would just quickly second Barbara's comments, and I do want to note that I think from the council's perspective, one area that we have concerns that may actually further concentrate the industry is the issue of convergence of accounting standards. And the simple fact is I'm not certain that the mid and small cap companies have the capabilities to move in that direction, at least rapidly, and I think it gives really a competitive advantage to the big four, which could further sort of exasperate, the perception that there's far too much concentration in the industry. Or profession, Mike.
I think you have to give people the information you need to in the marketplace so that they can force the firms to compete on quality. Currently, that information is just not out there, and so they're competing on fees at this point in time. And I think if you go to some type of mandatory rotation tied to forcing the auditor to tie into the investor, as once again as Gus mentioned, and in that annual report you start requiring disclosure with respect to information so people can differentiate on a quality basis, then I think you'll start to have greater competition around the right issues, which would mean you'd have to provide that information out there, and the quality control factors is were proposed to the ACAP to be disclosed. Absent that, there is nothing you're going to do to change the current environment of the big four and then probably the next couple of firms. There's just such a huge magnitude difference and so much capital or volume and size advantages to those four that the others just literally cannot, will not, never will have a chance of catching up with them.
Well, to begin to wrap up, we said when we scheduled this that we give each member an opportunity in closing to put any issues on the table before us or make any closing comments. So, Joe, first of all, thank you very much for that superlative presentation earlier on. I thought you did a terrific job, and you and your group certainly spent a ton of time at it, and it's very much appreciated. I think maybe the best way to summarize the discussion is with the question that last May, I think, Lynn, you told us Warren Buffett used to ask when he was on the audit company's audit committee, and that is, what is it that the auditors know that if they were investing in this company, they as investors would want to know and have out there publicly? I think that was a telling comment, and I think that you addressed a number of those issues in your presentation, but why don't we start with you and go around the table and we'll finish up.
Yeah, I think this was an extremely good meeting, like our first meeting, Steve. I think the only comment I'd make, and this is really for you and the rest of the board, is I think these get-togethers, this is a very unique group, not leaving myself out. I don't want to give myself credit, but I think it's a very good group. I think it has a very good perspective. I think the involvement today from the SEC was very helpful, and I would just encourage you to have a more regular schedule now that there's a full slate of board members in place.
Robert Tirola here. I also think this was a very informative meeting, and it was good to hear the views of the board members as we focused on these various topics. I think you have an opportunity to improve the system as well as improved the profession. Not just the quality of it, but the financial benefits of it. Because I think you could move toward a relevance model that is to their benefit as well as to investor benefit, and I think you can create a win-win.
Mike, and I want to say that to Jim and Brian and to you, thank you very much for participating today. We look forward to our ongoing relationship with you, and if you have any comments, we welcome
them. Nothing to add other than to thank you, Steve, for having us here, and I agree with you. I look forward to ongoing discussions. Thank you.
Steve, I'd say the interaction with the board this week today has been great. In the past, the board hasn't been as active in question and all, so I very much so enjoyed the interaction and thought it was good, and hope we'll have the same type of interaction at next week's SAG. So, but with that, I think you know what the issues are. I think you got a good handle around what the issues are, and I look forward to seeing what the board does.
I do congratulate you again for an outstanding meeting. Maybe we ought to consider the next time hearing from the auditors.
Judge, I believe deeply in transparency, and so we'll take that, I think, under advisement at the board, but I have no problem whatsoever at any time not only hearing from investors in an open meeting, but from the profession in an equally open meeting.
As Mike said, we were talking about words, and I'll use one right now. Given all the praise for this committee, we're bordering on hagiography now. And I'm not into idol worship, so I won't take it over there. But it has been a good meeting. I appreciate the opportunity to do this, and I'm certainly more than happy to continue and help in any way possible. Thank you for the opportunity.
Steve, nothing further on the substance of today's discussions, which have been wonderful. It is great to see all five chairs occupied and occupied by men of such skill and obvious interest in all that we're doing. I want to thank you, Steve, for your stewardship of this process. I've been members of other advisory boards and groups in the past, and you know, all too often the model is you meet two or three times a year and everyone comes and there's a lot of energy and enthusiasm, and then it sort of goes flatline until the next time you meet and there's energy and enthusiasm and it kind of falls off again. That doesn't happen here, and that's a tribute, I think, to you and your work. I was very pleased both last year as these things occurred, but to hear your recap this morning of the significant work that was done in the immediate aftermath of our meeting last year to follow up on the issues that were discussed there. And I am optimistic that the same will be true here and that you'll not hesitate to certainly call on us for further input as the board moves forward. And do hope that we'll be having occasion to gather again in the not distant future. Thanks.
Yeah, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to participate today. I very much enjoyed the comments from the board, from all the members as well. And really, I'm excited about the prospects that we can get better information for investors. I think that's what it's all about.
Steve, just wanted to thank you again. I think there's a lot to report back to the chairman when she left. She said she wanted to hear back. There's a lot to report back, and really look forward to working constructively as you take leadership in this area.
I just want to thank the PCOB board and staff and the SEC staff for spending the time today. You both have, or both agencies have, the important mission of protecting the interests of investors, and I do think that investor voices too frequently are not maybe articulated, perhaps we're not vocal enough or visible enough on some of these policy debates. So I think this committee is very special, that this is a group of investors trying to propose reforms reflecting the needs of investors. So, Norm, I'm going to follow your comments, and not only am I looking, I think I just want to urge the board to act on those issues that I think have been studied for many, many years, in some cases decades. Let's make sure that we're taking the lead here in the U.S. as opposed to waiting for other regulators to act, and to methodically, but I think aggressively, study those issues that need to be studied. And I very much look forward to hearing the progress report at the next meeting.
Yeah. Hi, Barb Roper. I second everything everyone said. I mean, I really do appreciate
the time all of the PCAOB board members have taken and the attention, the SEC staffers, to spend essentially a full day listening to us express our views. I have almost a second career as an investor advisory board member. Feels at times as if it's half my time in various different capacities. And, you know, I can't recall a time when I've seen one, as someone else pointed out, the immediate responsiveness to the board after our previous meeting, which I think helps to inform the degree of energy that people brought to this meeting. When you know that you're talking and it doesn't just sort of echo away down the halls, that it gets serious attention, that really makes a difference. And I thought this was terrific. So thank you.
Brian Croteau, and I'll just follow along with Jim and Mike and really thanking you, Steve, for inviting us today, and to the full board, really commending you and in the group here today. I think a lot of really excellent dialogue as we think about audit quality and improving audit quality for the benefit of investors. I think really getting at identifying what are the real problems we're trying to solve, what are the root causes of those problems, and what are the right next steps. And there's really a lot to think about coming out of today's meeting, and so really thank everyone for that participation. In particular, I thought a lot of the input from the survey on the auditor's reporting model will be very helpful to the PCAOB standard setting project in this area. So really look forward to continuing our work together with the IAG and with the PCAOB on projects coming out of the discussions today. So thank you.
Well, I think a lot of the momentum that we brought today was as a result of Dan's efforts and leadership in terms of the list of priorities that he met. Dan, I don't know whether you or other board members want to make closing comments.
The only thing I'd say is I'm sitting here thinking about all the things that were on our agenda already and then all the additional ones you've added today. We're going to be very busy over the next 6 months.
I just like to say, listening to all this today, it seems to me our job is really quite simple, and it's simply to be worthy of you.
And I before letting the chairman wrap up, I want to thank all of you again. I think you put a ton of effort into it. It's easy for us, at least speaking for myself, to spend a day listening to you. I welcome it. Sometimes I like to hide behind the umbrella of the ideas that you bring to the table and lay a foundation so that I can be supportive or, in those instances, non-supportive, but I certainly like to hear it. And I especially want to thank Joanne Hindman, who has been invaluable helping us on all aspects of today's meeting, both substantively and organizationally. So, Joanne, it could never have happened without you. Appreciate it very much. And, Mr. Chairman, I leave the closing remarks to you.
I'll cede my time to the chairman.
I thought you gave me the nod that you didn't want to speak.
I really have nothing to add except to say thank you to I said last night to the investor advisory group, that there may be a group that we talk to who is as important as this one, but there isn't anybody that we talk to in the year that are more important than this group. And you're doing a great public service. Thank you all.